You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is, of course, when we get you updated on the news that made headlines around our area this week. And today, our panel includes Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, Betsy Russell, the Boise Bureau Chief at the Idaho Press and the voice of the Eye on Boise blog, Margaret Carmel, senior reporter with BoiseDev.com, and Kelsey Mosley Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun. Good to have you all here, everybody. Okay, can y'all hear me now?
We can hear you.
Yay.
Oh, look at that. The wonders of technology. All right, let's get into it. Okay, Scott, I do want to start with a clemency hearing for a death row inmate. This is newsworthy because it's believed to be what? The only the second such review for a death row inmate here in our state since 1977?
Correct. Yeah, this is just the second time Idaho has held a clemency review for a death row inmate since then when Idaho reestablished capital punishment. The only other hearing of this kind was in 1996 when the parole board voted 3-2 to recommend the death sentence of a convicted murderer be reduced to life in prison. And at the time, then Governor Phil Batt accepted the majority decision and granted the request. So now this week we have the latest hearing for Gerald Pizzuto. He's a double murderer. He had his hearing before the Idaho Commission of Pardons and Parole this week. He's seeking to have his death penalty sentence reduced to life in prison. He was convicted in 1986 of the brutal murders of Berta Herndon and her nephew Del Herndon, who were struck multiple times in the head with a hammer and died at a remote cabin in Idaho County. He was sentenced to death in 86, but it's taken this long to reach the execution date, which was scheduled for earlier this year. But Pizzuto asked for clemency, for mercy from the commission because he is terminally ill. And he's been on hospice care for nearly 2 years. And his lawyers argued for mercy, asking the commission to allow him to die by natural causes rather than by lethal injection. The commission heard testimony from the state, and they heard from the victim's family members, and they also heard from Pizzuto himself and from Pizzuto's family members, and then they began deliberating. The process for the commission is a little bit of a mystery. They meet behind closed doors for their deliberations. The hearing was open to the public, but their deliberations are behind closed doors. We're not really sure what they're basing their decision on. They met on Wednesday, and they were scheduled to meet again this morning, and we're kind of waiting any moment to have a decision. And like you said, this would be the first time since 1996 that they've had such a hearing, and the last time they did this, they commuted a sentence down from the death penalty down to life in prison. So we'll see if that's what they decide. If they recommend that, it goes to the governor, who then orders that officially to commute the sentence down to life in prison. If they decide not to commute the sentence, then his execution will go ahead, and he'll get scheduled for lethal injection at some point in the future.
Betsy, can we talk a little bit about Ammon Bundy? We do know he's running for governor. And he's now apparently trying to make an argument that some court-ordered community service that he was expected to do, that he's completed it. A little bit of a twist onto how he's saying he's completed this.
This was really kind of a surprising development in a criminal case that had already been decided by a unanimous jury. Ammon Bundy was convicted of trespassing and resisting and obstructing officers, and was sentenced to some time served in jail along with some community service. And he had his campaign, his gubernatorial campaign, submit a letter to the court trying to argue that he's already satisfied his community service requirement because he spent far more hours traveling around the state, reaching out to voters, urging them to hold their elected officials accountable and getting them to register to vote. Now, of course, he was doing all that as a candidate for governor, out campaigning and going to campaign events. This is not an argument I've seen advanced before for how to satisfy court-ordered community service for a criminal sentence. And it seems to me probably pretty unlikely that the court will accept that argument. But we don't know for sure yet. There's not been word from the court yet. This development also came at the same time that Bundy had his appeal of his conviction dismissed for failure to pay the transcript fee, which is something you have to do when you appeal a conviction. You've got to assemble the transcript, and there are fees that go along with that. Mm-hmm. His lawyer is now arguing that the lawyer was sick and that's why they didn't pay the fee and this should be reconsidered. The court has not reconsidered anything as of yet on that. So we'll wait to see if anything changes. But these were certainly novel arguments to put forth as to the nature of campaigning and whether it is, in fact, community service.
Community service. Yeah, that's a new one. That is a new one. So, Margaret, Amazon could potentially be moving a facility to Boise?
Right. So we don't know this for a fact yet, but there's a lot of factors that indicate that an application for a new warehouse near the airport is likely. So this would be another significant footprint, you know, growth in the footprint of Amazon in the Valley. So it's called Project Dove, and it would be part of this business park that is south of Boise. It's being developed by a company that Gardner Bat Capital won't tell us yet, but this company has developed several other Amazon facilities in Utah. The architect developing the building is the same architect that builds all of the other Amazon facilities in the Treasure Valley, AO Architects. And if you look at the picture of the rendering, it looks exactly like the other Amazon facility in Nampa, same style, same type of building. Yeah. There's just a lot of things that are pointing towards this being an Amazon. We don't know exactly what the nature of this yet. If it's going to be a fulfillment center or a smaller distribution center, there's a couple different possibilities of exactly what sort of facility it will be. But we're going to keep our eyes peeled. The application calls for it would be 1.33 million square foot building. It's half the size of the facility in Nampa, though. So it's not as big as the facility out there. So we're going to see what's going to happen with this. But this is kind of another story in the growing Amazon presence here in Idaho.
Yeah, no kidding. Kelsey, can you talk to us about the need not just for more social workers in Idaho, but now we're seeing a shortage of foster families?
Yeah, and we've sort of always seen a shortage of both of those things, but it's right. Kind of reaching a crisis point from what I've talked to people about, and it's already there. It's not just reaching it. It's pretty dire from what it sounds like, and part of it is, you know, the two things are linked, where the social workers aren't available to support foster families who have kids with behavioral issues, and there's also long waits for behavioral health services, mental health services. And so they've had quite a few, at least 50 foster families turn in their licenses this year. And so that's a pretty big hit. And the reasons that they're giving are that they're unable to manage their child's behaviors. It's up about 6% from 2020. And so it's just a pretty big issue right now. And especially with COVID, I think that added some of it, where people didn't want to, you know, bring in strangers to their home, understandably, especially if they have kids of their own. And so they're really hoping for more recruitment and trying to get more people to come back on board if they've left. And it's just a really sad situation for everybody right now.
Yeah, it really, really is. Scott, there is a Boise State University professor who has been making headlines and waves, to say the least, about some comments that he made, I believe, at the end of October at a conference in Orlando. Can you give us the background on Scott Jenner? And I know other folks can chime in as well, but there's a lot going on here.
Right. So just the background, Boise State University political science professor Scott Jenner gave a speech at the National Conservatism Conference in Orlando, Florida, at the end of October, October 31st. His speech was about the role of women in society and the workplace. And it was a critique of at least what his perception of feminism is. He made the argument that feminism has created a class of career-driven, independent women, and that in his view has a negative impact not only on those women, but on society and the ability to create what he calls a great nation. He called independent women, quote, more medicated, meddlesome, and quarrelsome than women need to be. He said, our culture is steeped with feminism. It teaches young boys and girls that they are motivated by much the same things and want much the same things, you know, framing this as a negative. He said, girls are told to become as independent as boys are said to be, again, as painted as a negative. He also said the country needs to de-emphasize its colleges and universities, calling universities indoctrination camps and the citadels of our gynocracy. I think he probably made that word up. I haven't looked it up, but he said young men must be respectable and responsible to inspire young women to be secure with feminine goals of homemaking and having children. Every effort must be made not to recruit women into engineering, but rather to recruit and demand more of men who become engineers, ditto for med school and the law and every trade. Boise State University has issued a statement saying that this is academic freedom and freedom of speech, but that anyone who wants to file a complaint may do so. As you can imagine, there is backlash about questioning whether he, as a professor at the university, could treat female students equally without discrimination, and whether he can treat female colleagues similarly if he holds these views. And so there's been, as you can imagine, a lot of backlash in the community over this past week over these comments.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, let's talk about this piece. I mean, Scott, I know Betsy, if you want to chime in as well, this, I think a lot of people have also criticized Boise State's stance on this and what they have said or not said. A lot of people talk about, well, he's tenured, so you cannot do anything. Let's be very clear. If you're tenured, there are things that can get you fired. And frankly, I think there was a very good opinion piece in the Idaho Statesman, Scott, where it frankly, his grading practices should be investigated. And furthermore, how about the professors and other staff who gave this individual tenure, right? There are right. a lot of things that can be done, but what have we heard from Boise State other than this statement that they gave out?
Yeah, they also issued a statement supporting women in at the university. It was really kind of a milquetoast statement.
Thanks.
Just saying that we appreciate women. There was no reference to Jenner. You know, we don't know what's happening behind the scenes, but really publicly, that's all they've said. That's all that's come out. And, you know, so we'll see if something comes out of it. But right now, it's just kind of radio silence from the university.
I think that part of the reason that Professor Jenner's comments have drawn such a strong backlash, he has tried to frame it as a criticism of feminism, as if that's some radical mm-hmm. philosophy out there that's causing some women to want to be in the workforce and not just be homemakers. It's kind of like a throwback to the maybe the 50s or the 60s, when that was kind of the reality in America, that feminists were these radicals who didn't just want to get married and have kids, who actually wanted to do other things too. I don't think that's the reality in today's America. Certainly, we see women in the workforce, women going to college, not because they're feminists, but because basically they're participating members of our society. And I think that's why there's been such a strong backlash on this and why that backlash continues. I think the university is under considerable pressure to react and to do something more than its initial statement, which simply said, basically, a tenured professor can say anything they want. And I guess the question isn't necessarily whether a tenured professor can say anything they want, but what that means to those who they teach and interact with mm-hmm. and even evaluate.
Also, Boise State is kind of in a no-win situation here, because they've been the target of a lot of rhetoric about their diversity policies and classes that they have that are, the Women's Center has been under fire in their budgets and stuff. And so I think it's hard for them to make a strong stance when they feel like they've been very much under fire from conservative circles.
But I also think, speaking as a woman, I was not surprised by these statements at all. And it is because, frankly, I am a woman. I would love to hear from one woman who has been in a professional job or a job of any sort of any time in their lives who has not come up against this rhetoric. And what is surprising to me is everyone saying, wow, this is shocking that people feel this way in 2021. Frankly, I think there are a lot of Scott Yenners out there. And more needs to be done to look into, as Betsy, you said, his grading practices, right? His interactions with his colleagues, because he does have freedom of speech. Let's be very clear about that. He can say these things. But does what he says also impact how he has graded female students?
And I think we're starting to hear some evidence that it has. KTVB, for example, had an interview last night with a former student of Professor Yenner's who talked about the way she was treated in class, the way that she was graded, that he referred to female students in his class as sweetie and dear and honey, and that at the beginning of the class, he asked everyone in the class who had kids to raise their hands and then asked the men to lower their hands, told all the women whose hands were up saying that they had kids, you are going to fail this course. I mean, there were very strange anecdotes shared. I think they're very much outside the norm. I personally was never asked anything like that at any age of my life by a professor. I think it's a little weird.
Oh, right. And I think that that's where, you know, will Boise State, even though, as you mentioned, Kelsey, they are in a no-win situation, will an investigation be done? Will something more be looked at as more complaints are potentially filed? So it'll be interesting to see where this goes. With that said, I do want to move on to other topics. And Betsy, something that some people may not know about Idaho is that we do not have a governor's mansion. So since we do not have one, our state gives the governor a housing stipend. It's been a fairly significant stipend over the years, but what's going on with it right now?
It's roughly $55,000 a year. And there was actually a meeting of the governor's housing committee, which is the committee of legislators, to take a look at whether that figure perhaps ought to be increased, given what we've all heard about the increasing cost of housing in the Boise area. And there were figures presented that clearly showed that, you know, that wouldn't actually cover the full cost of, you know, a house near the Capitol and keeping it up and all that. But the legislators decided that right now really wasn't the time to consider raising that stipend of roughly $55,000 a year on top of the governor's salary, and that they'll consider that later. So that hot topic will be coming back. This has been a matter of debate for many years in Idaho. At one time, we did have a governor's mansion, although some people said it wasn't a mansion. And then we got rid of it, and then we paid a stipend, and then we had a house the former Simplot home donated to the state, but no governor ever lived there. Then we gave it back to the family. They demolished it. We still don't have an official governor's residence. We are still paying that stipend.
Right. And that's a stipend outside of their salary, we should note, Betsy. Yeah. Okay, Margaret, Babby Farms, for people who are not familiar, I wouldn't necessarily call it a petting zoo, but it's a zoo of sorts north of Caldwell. Lots of drama going on there. Can you talk about this?
So much drama. So a couple weeks ago, some former employees of Babby Farms started speaking out and saying that this nonprofit actually treats animals very poorly. They have a petition circulating that's got over 15,000 signatures Basically, Babby Farms is a place where you can go see like close to 100 different types of animals. They have everything from pigs all the way up to really exotic animals like bear cats, which are highly endangered. They look sort of like bigger versions of otters, and they have very sharp claws, and they smell like popcorn. Mm-hmm. They're very interesting animals. So they
was my high school mascot, by the way.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So there they you have, go. Just a little they, known fact.
Yeah, I learn new things every day. So they have you know, all sorts of animals there. And these employees were saying that the Babby Farms was not, you know, feeding them properly. Their cages were really dirty. They were not, you know, did not have enough staff to keep everything clean. I heard all sorts of stories also about animals biting or attacking staff members as well as guests. Because when you go to Babby Farms, it's not like Zoo Boise. You know, at Babby Farms, you can pay to have an encounter with animals where you, my understanding is you can go in and you can meet the animal. Zoo Boise does some of these sorts of things, but I think it's in a little bit of a different type of environment. So I heard stories, one story in particular of a family going in to have an encounter with an animal called a Coti Mundi, which is a native to South and Central America. And the young child was petting the Coti Mundi, but it turned out staff member did not have the proper training, and they took the family into the incorrect cage, and the Coti Mundi ended up biting the child, according to the former employee. That's a story I heard a couple of times. So now they were investigated by the state. They got a clean investigation record from inspectors from the Jim County Sheriff's Office, as well as Idaho Fish and Game joined the Idaho Department of Agriculture. They checked everything out. They had no issues, said that all the animals looked alert, happy, well fed. So we're not really sure what's going to happen with this, but the employees are still spreading the word and sharing some photos of animals that they say died on the farm, of causes they say were preventable. The other thing that's very interesting about this is Babby Farms is owned by a nonprofit called Trace Inc. that gets $25 million in government grants every year to employ people in the disabled community to do work on military bases around the country, ranging from Hawaii all the way over to South Carolina. They also have employees working in Mountain Home. So it is a nonprofit that is powered by government grants.
What's interesting to me, and I'm going to throw this way back, and Betsy, I think maybe you might be the only one who remembers this, but if you know where Garrity Boulevard is on Interstate 84, I believe this was all taken down in the early 2000s, but there was a family that had tigers, tortoises, all kinds of animals. And you could literally see these exotic creatures while you were driving on the interstate. Do you remember that, Betsy?
Boy, I don't, but we have had a number of exotic wildlife operations, many farms and things like that in our state and in neighboring states that have run into some serious trouble over the years, including, of course, the infamous liger incident in eastern Idaho.
Yeah.
So,
This
is an area that where there are both state and federal regulations dealing with exotic wildlife. I'm not sure if that's really the issues coming up with Babby Farms. The Idaho legislature has also struggled over the years about how it regulates care of animals. And so there are a lot of issues there.
Betsy, where is Idaho in terms of redistricting? And I guess let's go back to why we are having to do this.
Sure. Growth has been kind of the mantra for Idaho, as we've seen in recent years. And every 10 years, because of population growth, district lines have to be redrawn in order to preserve the principle of one person, one vote. In other words, if one seat in the legislature represents 100,000 people, and then the seat right next to them is someone who represents only 25,000, those 25,000 have more say, more clout in the legislature than the ones who have 100,000 people having to share a single representative. So every time the census is done, every 10 years, we redraw the lines to try to equalize the population, both for our legislative districts, of which we have 35, and our congressional districts, of which Idaho has only two. Now, we've gotten new plans drawn by our citizen commission, which the Idaho voters amended the state constitution and said that's how we want it done, not by the legislature. Those plans have been adopted. They've been put out there both for the legislative districts and the congressional districts. And now they are open to legal challenge. And there's still almost 2 weeks left in which legal challenges could be filed. We have seen three thus far. All three have gone after the legislative district plan, not the congressional district plan. And the concerns with the legislative district plan have all been about, for the most part, dividing counties, because our state laws say we should try not to divide counties. On the other hand, we've got 44 counties, 35 districts. Some counties have a lot of people, some only have a few. Some dividing of counties has to happen. And so two of the legal challenges so far say that the plan, which divides 8 counties, divides too many counties, and we should have only divided 7. The third challenge says, no, we should have divided 9 counties. So we'll see where those go in the court. What we have not seen filed yet is any challenge to the congressional redistricting plan. And there was some controversy there. The commission voted 4-2 in favor of this plan. And it is a plan that does the same thing that our congressional plans have done for the last 5 decades. It divides Ada County. But there was a plan submitted that didn't divide Ada County and still came within 102 people of perfectly dividing the state by population into two parts. And so the minority said, if we can get that close without dividing a county, and our state laws say we shouldn't divide counties, we should do that instead of the plan that's been put forth. The majority of the commission said it would be less disruptive to just keep moving that dividing line to the west, putting more Boise into District 2, keeping North Idaho and everything else to the west in District 1, than to draw up whole new district plans and come up with something entirely different just to avoid splitting counties. So that's something that could also be challenged, but we have not seen a challenge on that as yet.
And Scott, chime in here, because you recently wrote a piece in regards to the splitting of Ada County into these two different districts. And I have to say, I mean, sometimes, frankly, unless you keep on top of it, you don't know what district you live in. I think that's truly, because it's so bizarre that Ada County is literally split in half.
Yeah, and we've had a north-south line dividing the state into east and west districts for almost 70 years. It was like 1966, I think, was when this changed. And back then, the line was out in the sawtooths. It was, you know, somewhere between Fairfield and Sun Valley. And, you know, perhaps it made a little more sense then, but as we've grown, like Betsy said, that line just moved farther and farther west, and now it splits Ada County, Idaho's largest county, right down the middle around Eagle Road, and the proposed changes would just move the line a mile to the west and a mile to the south for, you know, just around Meridian and Eagle, out to Eagle Road, changing about 35,000 people. So it just moves 35,000 people out of District 1 and into District 2. And like Betsy said, there were a couple of maps, and there was one map that was proposed very early on that was kind of your quote unquote Treasure Valley district that included Canyon County and Ada County, as well as Gem and Elmore and Twin Falls and Boise and Payette and Washington, which, you know, to me makes a lot more sense, because you definitely have a community of interest with folks in the Treasure Valley. And as it is now, you're splitting Ada County in half, and you've got Canyon County in District 1 and half of Ada County in District 2, represented by Mike Simpson right now from Idaho Falls. And then there was another map that was kind of just the southern district. It would include the south. And again, those were proposals that didn't split any counties at all. Now, Bart Davis, who is the Republican co-chairman of the commission, he told me that the the one person, one vote was the most important federal standard that he took away, not necessarily the splitting of counties. So he was less worried about splitting counties and making sure that those balanced out. But really, when you're thinking about it, the census numbers, with all the deaths and the births that go on every day, those numbers have changed already. And I would argue that to split the county down the middle, which is the fastest growing part of the state, it's going to change a lot over the next 10 years. So, you know, I think they took the easy way out and, like Betsy said, the least disruptive. But I think that it would be wiser to have more of a Treasure Valley district or a Southern Idaho district. But I doubt we'll get a challenge on that, a legal challenge on that, because I don't know who would challenge that.
Kelsey, where are we in terms of campaign finance funds?
Oh, I just did this yesterday, so I have good updated numbers for you. Governor Brad Little continues to lead the pack with, he's closing in on 900,000 now, which is just a crazy amount of money to me. I'm sure it's par for the course with the governor's campaign, but it seems like a lot. and we're at about more than 300,000 between the two lieutenant governor candidates, Speaker of the House Scott Bedke and Representative Priscilla Giddings. So those are kind of the two big ones. And then there's quite a bit going on in the attorney general race, where I had been just tracking Arthur McComber up in Coeur d'Alene, because he was kind of the only one fundraising until Raul Labrador, former congressman, and he's part of the Help District now. But he announced, and then current Attorney General Lawrence Wasden said that he was going to run again, kind of just right after that. And so those two kind of are now competing for, you know, donation status. But Labrador is certainly winning that race, because he raised about 106,000 between November 22nd and yesterday, just between like 25 people. And so some of that came from businesses, and some of it came from people, and some own the same businesses that the $10,000 came from. So he's got definitely deep pockets that he can tap into, because he was a congressman, I think. And so those are kind of the big players. And then everybody else is just a little bit more calm, a little bit more infrequent with their donations. Phil McGrane is doing pretty well in the Secretary of State race. And so is Dorothy Moon, Representative Dorothy Moon. She's kind of in the Priscilla Giddings type circle. And she's been doing pretty well. She had 44,000 as of the end of November. And Phil McGrane has about 62. So it's heating up for sure. It's more and more frequent as I look at them.
Yeah, as we have 11 months until election day. Yeah, exactly. All right. Margaret, you have been on the program before talking about a piece of land in Southwest Boise. It was being looked at for development. That's not going to happen. And it's kind of back in the news again. So give us a quick, brief history of this, and then what's going on?
Well, it's almost impossible to do a brief history of McGurdio Park, so I'm going to do my best. McGurdio Park was bought by the city, or bought by the airport in the 90s, with the idea that it would conserve open space in the flight path of the airport. It was later acquired by the city of Boise under former mayor Brent Coles, with the idea that it would become a park. Spoiler alert, it never became a park. It's quite on the far edge of the city. It's actually outside of city limits. It's not annexed. The people around it do not pay city of Boise taxes. And so because there were never got annexed, the park has never been built, and it has been sitting there, and the McGurdio family has been leasing it from the city of Boise to farm ever since. Everything blew up last summer whenever the Mayor McLean announced the possibility of a land trade with the Harris family to have it be developed with housing under the median income or the median price in Ada County, and have a smaller 7-acre park instead. Neighbors got very upset, and this led to a lot of issues. And during that, the group Friends of McGurdio Park alleged several times, including at a press conference in front of City Hall that made its way onto KTVB and other local news stations, that the FAA would block any sort of development from this park because of its proximity to the airport and a lot of other reasons that are too complicated to get into right now. But the thing is that they made this allegation several times, but they never really showed any evidence. An investigation that I did showed that I couldn't find any conclusive evidence that the property was acquired with federal funds or that it would be blocked from the federal government. Anyway, keep that in mind. So in the midst of this kerfuffle, the city opted to hire an outside lawyer with specialty in FAA law to investigate this and basically figure out what legally can we do with McGurdy Park, given the nexus with the airport. And that report is out, but the city now will not release it. I asked them to release it. They said that they were keeping it internal because they have no plans to develop the park. And that's why they're not going to release that to the public. The property, you know, the project, the entire idea of it being developed sounds like it has been shelved indefinitely due to probably all of the public opposition to it. So, and the thing about this report is that it is legal advice is exempted under the public records law. So cities can shield these things from public records laws, but they have the option to release it. So the city can release it. They are just choosing not to and share what the finding of this attorney was, which was the, you know, is it legal essentially to develop this piece of property?
Betsy, talk to us about the governor's proposal in regards to unemployment insurance tax breaks for certain businesses.
Yeah, this was something that the governor unveiled at the Associated Taxpayers of Idaho annual conference this week. And he said that his proposal, which would require legislation, the legislature would have to act in January, would result in $64,000 in tax savings over the next 2 years to Idaho employers. And it turns out that after talking to his Labor Department director, Janie Revere, what it essentially would do is freeze the base tax rate for 2 years, and then after those 2 years, allow it to go back onto its formula to take out the impact of some early years in the cycle that were during a recession and would have otherwise caused the tax to go up a lot. The governor earlier committed $200 million in otherwise unspent CARES Act funds to bolster the state unemployment insurance fund. And what Janie Revere told me is that resulted in a small decrease in the tax for the employers, but more than that, it headed off what would have been a big increase. And so kind of the aim of all this is stability. The governor said in his view, this is a no-brainer, and he hopes that the legislature approves it earlier in the session, but he did just announce that this week. Now, that, of course, is among the less controversial of the tax discussions going on right now. And the governor also said that he is committed to real and immediate property tax relief. So we'll see what that means when he unveils his agenda in January.
But we have to wait for the legislative session to begin in January to see about this proposal for the unemployment insurance break.
Yeah, although I was able to get a fair amount of detail on that one because he actually announced it. The rest was all just hints. The governor talked about revamping Idaho's entire tax system, about maybe even looking again at income tax rates, about making sure that there's tax relief and investment into lasting things like education and roads and other infrastructure. But he's not going to fill in the details on that until he gives his State of the State address and releases his budget proposal to the legislature in January. That'll serve as a starting point for whatever the legislature then decides to do during their session.
And fingers crossed, it's not as long of a session as it was last year. But before we wrap up,
go ahead, Betsy. At the end, they'll have incentive to wrap it up.
yeah. Fingers crossed. Scott, we just have a couple minutes left, but I really do want to get to this story. And this is in regards to a historically derogatory racial slur that we have seen used in all sorts of things across our country, not just here in Idaho. It's the term squaw. And frankly, Scott, this is a really important change if this happens.
Yeah, this was announced just before Thanksgiving. U.S. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland formally established a process to review and replace derogatory names on geographic features. And she also declared squaw to be a derogatory term. And she ordered the Board on Geographic Names to implement procedures to remove the term from federal usage. And There are about 650 place names in the United States that use the word squaw. There are 70 in Idaho that have contained the word squaw, and probably the most well-known locally is Squaw Butte, iconic landmark north of Emmett. And this has come up before in Idaho, this debate about squaw. And the word apparently does have origins in rather generic term of to call a woman. But as we all know, it has language has evolved, and squaw has become a come to mean a derogatory term. And so this change is coming from the Secretary of the Interior. This is not without precedent in Idaho. This there are 22 places in Idaho at one point contained the word squaw that have since been changed. Most recently in 2007, several place names up in North Idaho were changed, got rid of the word squaw. And so this new process is meant to expedite and be a little more top down. There's going to be an advisory board that looks at all of these place names, and rather than require people to bring complaints and then sometimes take years to get names changed, this is supposed to expedite the process and be a little more proactive in getting these names changed.
Well, as always, I want to thank all of you for taking your noon hour to come on our program and talk with us. Our panel today, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, Betsy Russell, the Boise Bureau Chief at the Idaho Press, as well as the voice of the I Am Boise blog, Margaret Carmel, senior reporter with BoiseDev.com, and Kelsey Mosley Morris with the Idaho Capital Sun. Again, if you have not subscribed to all of these publications, I urge you to do that. Very good journalism going on there. Thanks, everybody. Have a really good Friday.
Thank you. Have a great weekend.
And I want to thank all of you for being a part of Idaho Matters. Our producers are Frankie Barnhill and Samantha Wright. Our executive producers, Paul Stribling and Tom Michael. I'm Gemma Gaudette. As I mentioned, it's Friday. The sun is shining. I really hope you have a good weekend, and we'll see you back here next week.